I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. It's time for Wisdom Watch, our conversations with leaders who've gone before us, those with experience and knowledge, not just smart, but wise. Our guest today, former Secretary of the Army, Clifford Alexander. He spent his career attempting to ensure equal opportunity for women and people of color, particularly in the workplace. His resume is a long list of firsts, including being the first African-American Secretary of the Army. So, Mr. Secretary, welcome. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you, Michelle.
You've spent most of your life fighting inequality. We want to talk a lot about that. But today marks the fifth anniversary of the beginning of the Iraq War. And early on, you took a strong position against the war, far earlier than many people in your peer group, people particularly with military experience. And just I'd like to ask you why.
When I saw the facts, I saw nothing that would provoke something unique in the American society. That is, that without being attacked, that the United States, on some very, very flimsy evidence, would go into another country, particularly a country with no overt threat to our society right here. There was a great deal of flag waving at the time, and there was a great deal of trying to, I think, change the subject for a relatively inactive president at the time who's spending his time somewhere after 9/11, down at the ranch before 9/11, not looking at the evidence related to that. And now you had a country coming together because we had been attacked by a group of disorganized, hateful people that really were not in Iraq.
Do you feel, though, that the president deliberately distorted available facts in order to arrive at the conclusion that he arrived at, or do you believe that he simply made a mistake?
I think almost the worst thing about this president is his lack of depth in anything. This is a man who seems to just react, and he is one of these people that we used to call them punks on the playground in Harlem. What they would do, they would be all big and bad before the game started, but once the game was started, they would often shy away because they didn't have the skills. This man has not had the skill in any particular area that I can see, and to commit men and women in uniform in their lives was a singularly irresponsible act.
So no secret here, but you're a Democrat.
I am a Democrat, but when I sort of list the things that I am, it's way down the list. But I am a Democrat, and I tried to, I hope with some success, when I was Secretary of the Army, not be a quote-unquote Democrat, because I think the issues were far more important than Democrat or Republican.
I do think it's important to point out that you are a supporter of Senator Barack Obama's candidacy for the presidency. That would be accurate, right?
It would be more than accurate. I am, and my son is the policy director of his campaign, and I've known him for over a dozen years, and Michelle. I think a great deal of him and of him substantively, and I certainly don't hide my praise of him.
But you also know the Clintons, too, and having been, you know, around for sort of quite a long time and having worked on these issues for quite a long time, just like to know why you think he's the best candidate for this position. And also, in contrast to Senator McCain, who obviously is someone that you would know.
Let me start first with the attributes that I believe makes him more than competent to do the job. He has a sense of reason about him. He is thoughtful. He has shown his capacity to execute, particularly during this campaign. He's run a fascinating campaign, which you have to put together. I ran for office unsuccessfully once myself in the District of Columbia. But this on a nationwide scale, raising more money than anybody else, having more volunteers than anybody else, winning, I think it's 29 out of, and his opponent, Mrs. Clinton, has won only 14 caucuses and primaries. That is extraordinary. There is this business that Mrs. Clinton often talks about. He hasn't passed the test for commander-in-chief. Well, she wrote the test, so I don't think your opponent writes the test for commander-in-chief. The real test for commander-in-chief is the test of whether someone is capable of seeing other human beings, their strengths and weaknesses, seeing the world on a much larger stage than I think either of the other two candidates do.
Just wondered how your earlier experiences kind of informed how you saw your job in Washington, what you thought you were here to do?
It's an excellent question. It's been so long, but let me see if I can recreate that sort of at least two or three parts to it. One part would be when I came to work for President Kennedy. I was working on the National Security Council staff with the late Michael Forrestal, the son of the former head of the Defense Department, James Forrestal, who was a delightful human being and a very smart one. My interest, however, was domestic policies, and my interests always have and will be till the day I die, better opportunities for women and minorities in this country and for everybody else. But they're the ones who need, if you will, the most attention and discussion in this country. So I was lucky enough to work with a man named Louis Martin. Louis Martin was better than great. He was from your profession and also a politician. He was a owner and writer for the Sengstat Publications, and he also was a man who did a great deal to get black people into the Kennedy and Johnson administration. When I worked for President Johnson, I was one of his three counsels. That took a different kind of skill. And in working for him, it was a particular kind of skill. And I handled the interactions with governors and with mayors. I handled presidential pardons. And most importantly, I handled civil rights. And I interacted on his behalf with Martin Luther King, Dorothy Height, Roy Wilkins, Whitney Young, John Lewis, the heads of the leadership of the civil rights movement.
What was he like? What was Lyndon Johnson like?
Well, the best thing about him to me was that he treated me as a black aide the same way he treated his white aides. He was loving in 10 seconds and right in your face at another point. At one point, we were all working on the Voting Rights Act of 1965, and we were asked to go brief various members of the press. And I was briefing Carl Rowan over in a restaurant. In those days, you had cars that would pick up aides, and so I was put in a car and told the president wants to see you in his office. I went in the office, and this was to brief Carl that the Voting Rights Act was going to be sent up that afternoon. And I walked into the president's office, the Oval Office, and he showed me this huge headline in the Washington Star that said, President to send up Voting Rights Act. So he, for about 45 minutes or a half hour, seemed like about 10 hours, proceeded to diminish me for putting this headline through Carl Rowan and having it
You messed
there.
Up, basically.
I
In
messed
other
up.
Words, you messed up.
And he said, we're not going to have a Voting Rights Act. Your people will not benefit. So there I was. Now I was about 2 inches tall. That very same night, I was part of a briefing in the White House with several members of Congress, and President Johnson pointed to me and said, that's one of my great and splendid aides, Clifford Alexander. So he did all that in one day. But when you look at his record, I once did a memo for him on his first 100 days, and they were far greater than Roosevelt's 100 days because he did and caused to pass legislation in civil rights. He had the Civil Rights Act of 1964. He had health matters. He had education matters settled, and he understood the legislative branch better than any president before or since.
If you're just joining us, I'm having a Wisdom Watch conversation with Clifford Alexander, former Secretary of the Army. You were chairman of the EEOC from 1967 to 1969. You held two historic public hearings on the workplace conditions for women and minorities. And I know it was a long time ago, but I just wondered if you remember any of the testimony from that time and how people reacted to it.
Oh, I do. I remember those very, very well. The first was 1967. And the second was in 1969. In 67, it was New York City. In 1969, it was in Los Angeles. What I did in the hearings in New York was one part of it had to do with talking to the media, talking to the New York Times, ABC, CBS, and NBC executives. And because of their paucity of hiring, particularly of, we used to call ourselves Negroes at the time, and also Hispanics and Latinos, and women as well. We also talked to the advertising industry, which even to today is doing a very bad job of including minorities in particular in their hiring. And I remember a particular one with the person from the New York Times was telling me about their great editorial positions on inclusion and seeing to it that people had great opportunities. And I remember saying to him at the end of the testimony, why don't you practice what you preach? Because indeed at the New York Times they weren't doing a darn thing about giving black people or Puerto Ricans in New York City an opportunity to be reporters. Well, the answer was non-existent because there was not a good answer. They did not practice what they preach. And unfortunately, till this very day, we see in most areas of the media, in radio and television and the written in particular in the newspaper world, that the inclusiveness, and I like to call it inclusiveness, not diversity, the inclusiveness is not their top priority, nor is it a place where they see how important it is for them to be able to hear views, conservative, Republican, from Latino, Asian, black, male, female, and they don't get it yet. They still think that if they have a good symbolic job of doing something, they've done something. But it's much, much more than that, and it was at least the beginning. I remember particularly with...
I think what I hear you saying is that you think the media is actually behind other business entities. Is that right? Is that what you're saying?
I think the word would be way behind. I'm sorry to make it that profound, but it's exactly what it is.
Why do you think that is?
I think part of it is that the media becomes quite self-serving. It talks about itself in grandiose terms but does not like the criticism of itself. And so in order to understand why you should be inclusive, you have to understand and discuss honestly that you have a problem. And the media in this country doesn't do that. Then groups from within the media are set off, black people are set off, Latinos are set off, women are set off to their own specific conferences to talk about their own specific problems. But the people who can do something about it aren't really that interested in it, nor are they included in those conferences. And I think if you sort of simplify these matters, it helps a good deal. When I was Secretary of the Army, when the issue of women in the Army came up, I would say women in the Army are soldiers in the Army. Just think of it that way. And say they would say, oh, well, let me see. If they're in the Army, will they have to take care of their children? So we did a little study of that, and we found out that males who had to take care of their children were less responsible about their posts than females. If you're in the Army, you have to get to your post. There's no question about that. So if you're a female, you arrange to do it. If you're a male, you arrange to do it if you have children. So the stereotypical thinking has to get out of the heads of people. And I do think that we have to, in this society, start to, the old term is peel back the onion, but it is we must think more thoroughly about issues of inclusion.
I wanted to ask you, though, given that your time, you know, in government service at the Department of the Army, at the EEOC, you were so much involved with both gender equality and racial equality. I remember hearing you tell stories about how some of the ridiculous objections there were to placing women even in civilian jobs, yep, in the Army, like in the general counsel's office. Given that you've spent so much time on both issues of gender and race, how do you react to the way those issues are playing out in this presidential race, being mindful of the fact that you do have a candidate that you particularly like?
Well, I like that candidate, but your question, I think, was the broader one about how it's played out.
Yes.
And it's almost comical how simplistic the discussion of it is. The issue of inclusion of people, men and women, is an issue of how do you overcome stereotypical behavior on the part of all of us. When the newspapers and radio and television train us that women act a certain way, do a certain thing, that obviously affects the mind of the employer. So there is a presumption that a woman, if she's going to a law firm, may end up getting pregnant and therefore may end up not being able to be a good partner for us. Or that a woman in a law firm, if she travels with a male colleague, will somehow get involved in an affair, and that the male colleague's wife should worry about that. Those are actual issues that I have heard raised within the last decade, and I raised today. So we have to get over stereotypical behavior about what a woman can and cannot do and start to say, which we should, that there's any job that a woman should do, you should put them in that job. When I was Secretary of the Army, we had the restriction that still exists with the Army alone on keeping women out of combat. I don't find a woman's blood any more precious than a male blood, so I don't see why they shouldn't be in combat as long as they can do those jobs. That's a major discussion and argument in the society today.
I wanted to ask you, just as a final thought, having spent so much of your career talking about issues of and trying to address issues of sort of inequality and inclusion, given that this issue is so much in the news right now, how would you like to see the country go forward in talking about these things?
I would love to see this country talk about those issues as it talks about other issues, with completeness but not exclusivity. The problem now is that we're going to have too much concentration on the issue of race because you have a black man running for president. Too much reaction to anybody saying anything that interrelates to his race because he is what he is. The discussion really is not about him. The discussion is, what is it that people who are similarly situated or look the same, what is it they face? The discussion ought to be by Hillary Clinton and those around her and those who are talking about her, not that she is a woman, which is pretty obvious, but the most important thing is, what is it that women face? And do women in cities face one thing and women in rural America face something else? Do women in the services face one thing and something else in corporations? Do black women find there are different issues or Latino issues that they face when they are women and Latinos? That is at least the beginning of how one needs to talk about it. And one need not create a more discussion about differences than is necessary. I often talk about in my business, I talk about inclusion, not diversity. Because if the job for me is to move A to B, it's no different for a woman than it is for a man. It's no different for a Latino than it is for an Asian. So we have to understand that when we're talking about the workplace or we're talking about getting educated, the requirements are about the same. The differences may be in the background of a person or from whence they came or what they're hearing in their life, and one ought to see how that richness might help us all. I find Black History Month to be something where what happens on March 1st, I don't quite know, since February is Black History Month.
Women's History Month.
Well, that's right, I forgot that. But I think we all, you know, I'd like to see more people not of color come to the lectures during Black History Month. And frankly, I'd like to see it back to a week or a few days. But beyond that, let's be substantive about these issues and not just talk about them and move away from them during months other than February and March, but let's think about them, work on them, and have a better country by acting on them.
Clifford Alexander, former Secretary of the Army, former Chairman of the EEOC. He's now President of a consulting firm, Clifford Alexander and Associates. He was kind enough to join me here in our Washington studio. Thank you so much for coming in.
Oh, thank you, Michelle Martin. It's a pleasure.